I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy Mars Hill Church. I'm not really sure what I believe anymore, and I am okay with that.
I'm Dave. I'm a Bible theology nerd, an occasional preacher, a movie buff. I'm definitely a Pentagon asset. Oh, and I'm a committed Christian.
And, you know, Dave, friends are friends forever if the pod's the pod of them. So as long as we keep doing this, I think we'll be golden there.
Friends forever. Many friends.
Absolutely. This is Veterans of Culture Wars.
Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we have conversations about evangelical Christianity, welcoming you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. And for this upcoming episode, we've had a little bit of a break. We're excited to be back. I am going to put the VCW Hall stamp of guarantee that this is going to be a fantastic episode. If you want, we do have a Patreon, patreon.vcwpod. If you want to support the show, please like, subscribe, rate, review us wherever you like to get podcasts. But Zach, let's bring our guest in because I am super excited for this episode.
Yeah, today on the show, she's a wife, she's a mother, she's a superstar. Wait, sorry, I got my notes mixed up here with Pat Robertson's notes for introducing Amy Grant on the 700 Club. Let me shuffle. Okay, yeah, sorry. Our guest today is a professor of American religious history at Portland Seminary and a public fellow at PRRI, the Public Religion Research Institute, which was founded by our recent guest, Robert P. Jones. She co-hosts the podcast Rock That Doesn't Roll and is the author of the brand new book. I believe at the time that this episode comes out, it will have come out. Wait, it's coming out tomorrow, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we are recording this on January 31st on a Wednesday. So yeah, it is out and you can get it. The book, God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music. Welcome to the show, Dr. Leah Payne.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here. And I love that you used the Amy Grant intro. That felt like a little present. You already read the book, I can tell.
Oh, absolutely. Every word.
Pat Robertson has made it on our show before, back in our episode of Billy Horde. Zach actually played a clip of him talking about trans people.
Oh, yeah. When he was like, I don't get supportive. The big deal. Seems yeah. fine.
You know, what's fun about Pat yeah. Robertson is really you could just never tell what he was going to say, you know? So yeah. There's a lot of folks where you can kind of predict, but you think you're going to know. And then he would surprise you. So.
All I knew is whatever he would say is what my grandma would think.
Oh, is your grandma a Pat Robertson fan?
Daily. Oh. She was part of the club.
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Clearly, we need to have another conversation, a side conversation about that. I love to hear those stories.
Oh, off the record. Well, Dr. Payne, we begin with asking our guests their journey with evangelical Christianity. And I know you must have grown up and probably maybe still do to some extent love contemporary Christian music, which we're going to be talking a lot about. Would you like to talk about your story?
Sure. Journey with the faith? Sure. You know, it's funny because I grew up, and I share this in the book, I grew up in a very small Pentecostal church. And you know, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I don't know if y'all, did you grow up in the Northwest?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I stayed in the Seattle area
okay,
my whole life.
Okay,
okay. I was a Vineyard and Foursquare guy.
Ah, okay. So it's funny. I didn't really think of myself as a particular kind of Christian until I moved to the South. When I lived in Tennessee, all of a sudden I realized, oh, there's like people have a much different kind of palette for understanding Christian identity and stuff like that. So, but it was a small town church, and I have never really felt, that I grew up in evangelicalism proper, in part because of class. So I think a lot of kind of the evangelical norms, the consumption patterns that are associated with evangelicalism, weren't a huge part of my childhood growing up. But I definitely grew up Pentecostal. So, I mean, you know, flag waving and shofar blowing and all of that stuff. It was a very lively spiritual universe, Jericho marches, et cetera, et cetera. So I grew up that way. But my dad, who was a pastor at that time, really didn't care for CCM. So even though I grew up in a world that was deeply influenced by contemporary Christian music, we didn't really play it in our home. And so I knew what it was. Everybody I knew, you know, in youth group and stuff was a part of that that world. But it wasn't in my home in the same way that it was for a lot of my peers. And so it didn't really have the same kind of emotional formative power for me. But of course, you know, if you grew up in a Pentecostal church in the 1980s and 1990s, you saw a Carmen song being performed on stage, or you knew somebody who had been to an Amy Grant concert or something like that. So I grew up in a world that was very much formed by all of these musical music and entertainment figures that are in the book. So I know you all did too, especially Vineyard and Foursquare. That's a very, you know, my dad was a Foursquare pastor. That's a very like Vineyard and Foursquare, like sibling kind of traditions. Did you go back and forth, or were you?
No, started with a Vineyard church that was planted by a pastor that came up from California, like that was like part of the Calvary movement.
Oh, right.
And then in high school, so basically we were part of that church my whole life until high school, and then we switched over to a Foursquare church that was pastored by Jack Hayford's brother.
Oh yeah,
Jim Hayford. Yeah.
Yes, of course I know who that is. Yeah.
And I remember my dad saying that the bassist of Second Chapter of Acts played at our church and stuff like that.
That's a big deal. That's a very big deal.
My parents were very I mean, we can get into this later. My parents were extremely plugged in business-wise. They had a Jesus People band in the 70s. They started a parachurch ministry / CBA store in our basement that was like a worship leader supply place. Like, we provided your Christmas musicals for your kids. We provided the choir robes and the octavos for your choir. I packed and shipped a ton of those things personally. You know, I worked for them over the years, starting by as, you know, like 9 years old, stamping envelopes. And then by high school, I was like working there, you know?
Oh, so you lived this book. You lived it like in your soul.
Oh yeah. When you brought up somebody with the last name Benson very early on, I was like, oh, this is going to turn into Benson Music, my dad's favorite sweatshirt.
Oh, that's so sweet. Oh, I love that. Yeah. Wow. I love to know that. How about you, Dave? Were you like, is this world your world as well?
It was not my world until I was 14. That's when I got saved and became a Christian, but I did not have much experience in the charismatic or Pentecostal side of things. That's a definite difference with Zach and I as we were coming up, but I was still immersed in contemporary Christian music, CCM. I have this as one of my questions. When I was 15, it was 1995. So 1995, 1996, I would say, I mean, that kind of has to be the golden era, right? And I'm biased because that's kind of my formative years, the golden era of CCM, when all of the those big bands were releasing albums that maybe some people still listen to for nostalgia or fun. And right before, you know, as you chronicle in your book, the worship craze kind of took over, and CCM pretty much just became all worship music or people trying to sound like Coldplay a lot.
Yeah. You know, I think, I mean, I agree that I think from 1995 to 2000 is probably what I would identify as the peak of CCM's power. In terms of its cultural influence and in terms of the size of the market. And technically, the most profitable years were the early aughts. But I think already the cultural power was ebbing for a lot of different reasons that I talk about in the book, but some of them include the internet and stuff like that. But, yeah. But yes, I think, you know, 1995, Jesus Freak, Jars of Clay, those were big albums that, and they were still, the world that supported CCM, the youth group culture that supported it was really at its height. And so, yes, I think you did, which is, it's interesting because, for a lot of people who I've talked with along the way, it's been a weird experience for them to realize that culture didn't always exist and that it had a relatively short life. The kind of the world that created that music and entertainment culture, because when you're in it, it's just so overwhelming and it just seems like it's always been there. So if you were 14 and then, I mean, those are very formative years. Did you have a favorite band when you were?
We love DC Talk Jesus Freak. So that was playing in our youth group all the time. Jars of Clay, self-titled debut. I think this missionary group called Operation Barnabas came to our church, and that's when I first heard of Jars of Clay, because one of the guys had it, like, this is a brand new album, you got to check this out. And this was before Flood on that album became a huge single on our alternative radio station, which is up here in Seattle at 107.7 The End, started playing that. And as youth group kids, we were just blown away that a Christian group was getting this huge exposure on, you know, secular radio.
Yeah, it's funny because I remember that too. I remember being with some friends in a car and Flood came on our progressive rock station, 94.7, here in the Portland area. And somebody said, this is a Christian band. And I remember just saying, no, it's not, you know, because for a lot of different reasons. But anyway, I thought that is really fascinating. Yes, those were really huge years for all the culture that upheld contemporary Christian music was firing on all cylinders. So like megachurch culture, the suburbs, you know, suburban culture, the consumption patterns and the idea that there were a lot of predominantly white evangelicals worshiping all together, many generations of them. I mean, just a lot of things had to go right to create that kind of world. And you were raised at the peak of it, I think.
Yeah. Well, I came into the church because I wasn't familiar at all with church culture really before 1994 when I was 14. And so, you know, especially with DC Talk, when they covered Larry Norman's song, I Wish We'd All Been Ready, which was written back in the 70s. That's exactly what you're talking about. Like, I had in this mind, oh, this is what Christian music has always been. Mm-hmm. I was completely unaware of the history and a lot of the stuff that you go into in your book. In 1996, Newsboys' Take Me to Your Leader came out. The Breakfast song is really annoying, but there's a lot of fun stuff on that album. And Audio Adrenaline Bloom, I mean, yeah, it was like the mid-90s. Those were my favorite bands that we were listening to all the time.
Oh, that's really neat.
I mean, I want to get into the book, but I will say I think I kind of differ with Dave on that being the golden era. I just think that is the most powerful era of corporate CCM.
Mm-hmm.
This is when everything was totally Nashvilleized. Most of the labels had been subsumed by larger, Universal Music Groups, you know, big corporate conglomerates. But at the same time, it was the dichotomy. I think what made it really special was the dichotomy of these massive corporate CCM groups and the sort of getting back to the roots of the independent movement of CCM and its origins by having the emerging underground punk labels of stuff like Tooth and Nail and all that. I think that's what's, to me,
that's
most
what makes it
interesting.
Yeah, because that 90s stuff was happening all at the same time. Yeah, I think that's... You know, there are a lot of kind of big stories, big narrative arcs that I try to follow in the book. And one of them is how a surprisingly small amount of people created contemporary Christian music, and it had this international reach. But really, it's a conversation between people in the American South and on the West Coast.
Yes.
And so the West Coast has this really fascinating indie scene that, you know, I don't know about y'all, but I'm not even, you know, digital age native or whatever they call it when you're like raised with the internet. I'm not that, but it's even hard for me to really remember what life was like before the sure. internet. And all of those West Coast bands had developed networks that were not dependent on the internet, didn't exist yet. They were informal, mostly in charismatic congregations like Calvary Chapel churches and Vineyard churches, Foursquare churches, all the way up and down the West Coast. And they had, while all these corporate things were going on in Nashville, this scene was still developing, and it was really developing off of the general philosophy that went into Jesus music in the 1970s, which yeah. is we should foster an environment where young people make music for other young people that is like in, that is, it has evangelical ideas embedded within them. And so there's a really robust scene, that was sort of just waiting to, waiting for, like to connect with larger audiences, and eventually they did. And then you get bands from the Tooth and Nail roster, MXPX, et cetera. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I think both of you are right. You know, like on the one hand, there's the corporate, the ascent of the corporate scene. And then on the other hand, this really thriving indie scene that I think it, at the end of the day, had a more sustainable, had a more sustainable marketing model because it was so grassroots. So the big corporate ones, were, it's kind of precarious when the money goes away. And yeah, it's really fascinating to see where all of those pieces end up, falling. But yeah, so you're both right. I say you're both right.
Well, what I love about the book is that going in, it's reasonable for people to assume that it's going to be focused primarily on music, that it's going to be sort of a cursory overview of here's the most important bands, artists, blah, blah, blah. Hey, here's how this band formed. Here's, you know, when this song came out, what was the impact on that? But it is so much more than that.
Oh, you, thanks.
you recently, like a week ago, you tweeted out a really good description. I thought you said it explores how the CCM industry homogenized and popularized specific versions of evangelicalism over time. And that gets to the heart of what I found so wonderful and surprising about it. It's not just an overview of those trends and things like that. It's about how music fits into the overall project of evangelicalism in the 20th century through the present, how it's used to define a faith in the public consciousness and contribute to white evangelicalism's ultimate goal of power. And we've talked about that a lot on here as we've had various episodes regarding white Christian nationalism and such. And it does all of this in about 200 pages. It's really phenomenal what you've done here.
Oh, thank you.
Why was it important to you to present the story of CCM in this way?
You know, I appreciate you bringing up the short part about the book because it's not a really long book. And I've been thinking about this. Somebody else pointed that out to me the other day. And I was thinking about one of my favorite books is by Virginia Woolf, and it's called A Room of One's Own. And it's a book that talks a lot about how women write. And one of the things that that she talks about that is that the form of writing oftentimes can't be the same for women because they have these other responsibilities in their lives. And so I've thought about, somebody asked me, why is it so short? And I thought, I don't think I have it in me to write a longer book. I've got kids. Yeah. No, but what I try to do is it's the story of a market and how markets shape religious movements. So that's the reason why I wanted it to be the shape that it's in. So, you know, you could talk about music shaping church communities in Christian movements. And where would you start? You'd start with the New Testament, right? Like, because music has always been a very important part of Christian communities. So yeah, I couldn't do that. And somebody else has already done that. They've done a really good job. You know, doing a survey of gospel music, but I wanted to start with the business, and the business of contemporary Christian music was facilitated by certain technological developments that made making music, sheet music, and then recorded music more accessible for larger groups of people. And so prior to the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century, print publishing was super expensive. And so most people who created music for church communities, most of the businesses were located in Philadelphia or New York, and it was a relatively elite business. But in the late 19th century, early 20th century, these middle-class people, and because of how race and racism work in this country, almost overwhelmingly white middle-class people, were able to purchase and then produce, purchase print publishing like technologies and then produce music for of and for their communities. So for the first time, you get the music, the sounds of, in the case of contemporary Christian music, where I start the book is with the Bensons, and you get the music of the American South that includes white holiness, Baptist, and Pentecostal people. And what was surprising to me about writing the book was that the overwhelming majority of people who create this music come from those communities, and then eventually the charismatic communities, which are kind of cousin communities to Pentecostal movements. So it's actually a really small group of people. And, you know, the book is structured, I tried to structure it in a way to say, okay, when does this business start? And how does this business shape the overall landscape of Christian communities in the United States, generally, specifically evangelical communities? I hope it accomplished that, but that was the fun part for me, because I thought about it and I was like, well, how, you know, music, if you all, especially if you're musical people, you know that you cannot compete with a song. Like, there's almost nothing you can do, like a preached word, a political speech, some sort of ad. If it doesn't have music with it, like, good luck if you're challenged by a catchy song. So I wanted to trace, what the song. Yeah, I mean, people can really do almost anything. Like, the funniest thing about the most interesting thing to me was learning along the way that, you know, some of the first efforts to shape the American political landscape, especially when it came to the young, was temperance hymns. So songs that were trying to get people not to drink alcohol. And, you know, that's actually no small task to convince people they shouldn't do that. But if you get people, you know, really moved with a song, you'd be surprised. At least that's what the temperance workers found.
Coming back. I heard Mike Johnson tried to get alcohol illegal in New Orleans or something, apparently a while back, but
that's a fool's errand, I think.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. But yeah, and talking about like the early 20th century stuff, like, it's not even just music, but like religious audio, the transmission of religious audio is what you're going through here. I was fascinated by how you trace the line of religious recording and broadcasting, and how rock and roll, partially, it was this big threat because the popularity of it had radio stations pushing preaching off the air so they could fill airtime with rock and roll.
Thank you for noticing that detail. Loved that story.
Well, you're going to love this question then, because I know that you are an expert on Amy Semple McPherson.
Oh, yes. Yes. My lady. Yes.
Absolutely.
I love her.
And I want to read your book. My library doesn't have it, and it's like $100 on Amazon right now.
I'm so sorry about scholarly stuff. I just hate that about how expensive it is. I'm sorry. I wish I could change it.
Yeah. No, it's all right. But you mentioned her, and I know that she like wrote many, 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 many songs. But you mentioned her as a pioneer in Christian radio. Not always legally. She called it a cathedral of the air, which I thought is such an evocative phrase. Can you have the floor? Can you please talk about Amy Semple McPherson for a little bit and how she fits into the world of Christian music? And if you could explain the legal thing that I mentioned, that's pretty fun.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, any chance that I have in my life to talk about Amy Semple McPherson is always, I will take it every single time. So I just to let you know, I grew up in the movement that Amy Semple McPherson started, the Four Square Church. And so she was always a really, always a really important figure in my life growing up and still is. And when I started researching her, some of the just most amazing things I discovered, but one of them is that she was a very savvy media maker and a very savvy publicist. And she did a lot of things that were, I think, really smart. But one of the things that I wrote about in the book was that she was one of the earlier adopters of converting Christian worship experiences to radio, the radio waves. And she, and I think, you know, the fact that she called radio the Cathedral of the Air was such, it's so evocative. And it also, it re-envisions a worshiping community. It mm-hmm. takes bodies out of it. It, cause you don't need to actually be there to be physically present.
It's interesting that it's cathedral too, not chapel. Not because a lot of people right. like the intimacy of radio. She is not somebody that is about intimate worship experiences, right?
Well, it's like she is. I mean, she loves Jesus. If you ever hear her talk about Jesus, it's steamy. It's like medieval, medieval mystic. She loves talking about, you know, sure. her intimacy with the Lord. But it's
for a small
right.
gathering.
It's though. Grand. Yeah, it's grand. And she was always this person who really had. She was great at communicating a grand vision to people and getting them to buy in, because people contributed to making her church, Angelus Temple, and then funding the radio station and many other endeavors. And by the way, if you ever are in
still around,
Echo Park, highly recommend going to visit. It's a gorgeous Art Deco building, and there's a museum there and stuff. But anyway, so Amy Semple McPherson was, she understood the power of radio right away and was really quick to harness it as a preacher. But then she was just a consummate entertainer. And so she understood that you needed a lot of programming and that music would move people. And so oftentimes music would get used to fill space because you can't always have preachers and you can't always have church services going on. So she would get lots of different kinds of music and musicians to participate. And but one of the funniest things about her is that she was such an opportunist that she decided that she was going to use radio frequencies that did not belong to her. And so that's how she's sort of a part of creating like federal guidelines for how radio frequencies ought to be used. And one of the funniest things, I talked to a reporter who just wrote a story in Rolling Stone about how K-Love, the parent company of K-Love, is being very creative with federal guidelines with how they're buying up radio stations. And they may be regulated. Who knows? I'm not sure what will happen. But the thing that I was sort of charmed by was like, oh, they're still doing it. You know, like people are still trying I think what becomes evangelicals, because I think a lot of people would never have considered Amy Semple McPherson. She was too wild. She was a divine healer and she had, she was very Pentecostal. And so I think in her day, she would not have been considered part of the kind of mainstream, respectable, you know, version of conservative white Protestantism that we think of as evangelical, but she was a forerunner of that for sure. And she was always at the front end of thinking about how to use and to harness media and marketing culture for her message. And good luck keeping up with her. You know, I obviously was too young to know her in her lifetime, but I wish I would have. I'm sure she would have been something to see. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about Amy Semple McPherson. I just went on and on and on.
Oh no, that is so fascinating. Zach picked up on something, that contemporary Christian music was used to push forward like a certain vision of the Christian faith. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned some of the the racial issues that came up also in contemporary Christian music. And you write in your book about musical appropriation. And again, this is what makes your book so fantastic. I mean, it's the history, it's the artists, it's also the themes and the cultural stuff that was going on. And with musical appropriation, like we all know, you know, Elvis Presley appropriated black music. He was one of the biggest stars probably who ever lived on planet Earth. Like I think I was reading something about him recently, and it's just staggering, like how far his music reached across the world and how many albums he actually sold in his time. Eminem would famously rap later that he uses black music to make himself wealthy. You discussed how Christian music has its own appropriation, especially white evangelical culture appropriating music. This was a really interesting part of your book because the evangelical church is still so segregated. There's black churches and most churches are largely white. I think most churches that I've been a part of have been largely white, including Mars Hill, a mega church. Can you talk a little bit about how CCM did musical appropriation from music coming out of black church?
Sure. And, you know, I should say that I think a lot of it, you know, American society has been, you know, quite racially segregated. So some of this is generally true of American culture, broadly defined. And, you know, if this book were about mainline music, I would have another, you know, conversation because mainline congregations are often just as racially homogenous as evangelical, sometimes more so. So I don't, you know, my focus in this book has been about how the music illustrates ongoing cultural conversations and tensions in evangelical spaces. And one of the things that when I first started writing the book, I would talk to people who'd been involved in contemporary Christian music, and I would ask them, at first I started, it was not a good move. It was very brazen because I'm in scholarly circles. So I'd say, hey, you know, any thoughts about why it's so white, you know? And because it's overwhelmingly, historically speaking, overwhelmingly white. And that was not a great first question to give people. So I started to get a little bit more precise and talk about statistics and stuff like that. And I think one of the things that I hope is helpful for people who were in the industry itself to realize is that the patterns of consumption and appropriation go way further back than the creation of the term contemporary Christian music. So the train tracks of what becomes contemporary Christian music are set like 50 years earlier in the segregated South, in the Jim Crow South. And so this, you know, one of the earliest examples of appropriation that I use in the book is the Southern Gospel. If you know it as a Southern Gospel song, Old Time Religion, which is kind of an iconic Southern Gospel song, but it was a song that was popularized by the Fisk Jubilee Singers, a legendary African-American group. And it's a song, I mean, watching the journey of that song, I think is like a metaphor for understanding how music in contemporary Christian works. Because you have this song that comes out of it's an African-American spiritual that is tweaked by a white music publisher, and the style of it, you know, some of like the melody and the harmonies and stuff are tweaked to appeal to white audiences, then sold by that publisher. And it was hugely popular. And now it's you know, a part of the Southern Gospel canon. And so that trajectory, I hope, is helpful for people who, you know, if you think about the conversation starting in the 1970s, it doesn't necessarily make as much sense if you look at, okay, so these sales and marketing networks, these are the ones, it's remarkably consistent, you know, like a lot of the big sites for doing contemporary Christian music festivals are revival camp meeting locations that, you know, had revival meetings in the early 20th century. So it's, you know, and of course those were almost exclusively racially segregated. So it would be, you know, these would be white holiness Pentecostal Baptist meetings. And I don't know if I hope it's helpful for people to think of this as a multi-generational project that is deeply shaped by those patterns. And it so, you know, sometimes people think I hope it helps people think more like systemically about how these things work. Cause it's not as easy as you might think to say like, okay, we're just gonna change it. It's like, yeah, I can totally see how you would want to do that. And also this lets you know about how complex that task actually is, because these are very old relationships, old networks. And there are certain patterns and tastes and just ways of seeing the world that have been in practice for a really long time. That's to me the most fascinating, one of the more fascinating parts, is that these are things like grandparents pass on to kids, and their grandkids over time.
Sure. I mean, the industry was built in such a way to cater primarily to, if not almost exclusively, to white people. And you talk in the book about how even like the demographic profile that they put together for like the average or standard listener of CCM radio, they called Becky, which
Yes,
is an
Becky's.
extremely white name. Like they are not trying to reach LaFonda or whatever, you know, whatever is this super black sounding name. You know, that Becky is who they want. And Becky, among other things, gets her music from a CBA bookstore. The CBA, the Christian Booksellers Association, which my parents' business was part of, even though they weren't a typical Christian bookstore, they weren't selling the latest Michael W. Smith tapes. But they were part of the CBA. CBA, you mentioned they had these annual like big conferences that thousands of people would attend. Eventually it dwindled down to just hundreds. I went to one in 1996 when I was 14, because it was in Anaheim. And so my dad went every year and he was like, hey, we could go to Disneyland in the night if we do this during the day. So I went down and I met like the heads of Lilliness and Integrity, and I met Carmen and DC Talk and all these people. I got hospitalized a year later, and like one of the I think he was from Lilliness, this guy Sam Mahaffey, he was like the CEO at the time. He like sent me like an autographed picture of like the Kansas City Chiefs football team.
Wow.
I got to know these folks. And much of the rise and fall of the CCM as not just a worship genre, but the CCM pop music genre is paralleled by the rise and fall of the CBA. Can you talk about the rise and fall of the CBA and why that was so important to maintaining the health of CCM as a whole?
Oh, yes. And thank you so much for asking about that. You have so much personal experience. It's funny that you bring up the Anaheim meeting, because several people, they couldn't remember what year it was, but said that felt to them like the peak of the CBA. So it's really interesting that that's just anecdotal, but it's interesting that you bring that meeting up. But yes, the there were I look at evangelicalism as a historian in this book, as a kind of, I'm borrowing this term that other historians like Daniel Vaca use, as the term commercial religion. So, how do you know what evangelicalism is, and what do you know about it? I'm wanting to look at what people buy, and how they buy and sell, as kind of telling us a little bit about what evangelicalism is. And so, the CBA, the Christian Booksellers Association, was a part of a broader effort, in initially exclusively white, and then they did expand a little bit, but conservative Protestant networks that all decided they were going to collaborate together and set aside very significant theological differences, under an umbrella category called evangelical. And they did that in the 1940s and then 1950s. And so it's those networks, the Christian Booksellers Association is a part of that. It's also a part of the Religious Broadcasters Association. There are these commerce networks, and they are all working together. And through a series of events that, I don't know, you might call them accidental, or contemporary Christian music ends up getting distributed through these Christian booksellers. And that is a boon to the fledgling industry because it allows them to connect with audiences that are interested in Christian themed music. And then it also, there are pros and cons to that. The pro is that it allows this industry to get going in a pretty short amount of time. And it's hard to start new businesses, as any small business owner would know. But then the con is that it situates the music within that cultural world. And so Christian booksellers, CBA bookstores end up, they really grow in American suburbs that are predominantly white, and they become a really important cultural hub for evangelical life. So I don't have to, I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know, because I know for a fact, you know, that world, but music, people discovered music there, but not just music. I mean, there was, you know, sermons and Bibles and all kinds of merchandise, t-shirts and kitsch of all kinds. And so when Christian booksellers, when they were decimated by the arrival of online booksellers, the support network that upheld contemporary Christian music was just devastated. And in the book, I write about how it's hard to overestimate what a blow that was, because so many bands were discovered at Christian bookstores, or they did music like release parties, and they signed albums and they t-shirts or whatever at these bookstores. Christian moms, Becky's, were able to find music that they approved of for their children. And you're right, they were built on Becky, the composite figure, is like any other marketing persona, is built on a lot of stereotype and the kind of imagined. And then as the digital marketing got better, they were able to actually hone in pretty well on what a Becky was and what she wanted to buy. But the Christian bookstores were the place where these Beckys went. And so when the bookstores go away, the cultural center of what was contemporary Christian music, a big part of that goes away too. There are other things, but it's hard to overstate that. You know, I know your family, Zach, had one, but Dave, did you ever go to a Christian bookstore to get music?
Yes. Yeah, okay. We had, I grew up in Kent, Washington, and they had Christian Supply. So that's where, and being that it was close to Seattle, they, even in the late 90s, had, you know, kind of a tooth and nail section and all those bands there.
Absolutely. You know, yep. I talked to a lot of people who the tooth and nail and, other labels that had, indie type stuff like 5 Minute Walk, that set of music, there were oftentimes young men, some of them were women, but most that I came across were young men who got jobs at bookstores in part so they could get free music, which I totally get. And then also they were sort of like the clandestine dealers of this music that the hardcore music, not only sonically, but every now and then ideologically would not align with kind of the mainstream of CCM. So there were always these, in my mind, I just call them bookstore guys, who were weirdly pretty powerful tastemakers. And sometimes they were 16 years old, you know, but they were curating kind of a subversive musical culture all along the way in the youth group scene. I don't, were either of you those guys at any point in time?
No. I never worked at a Christian bookstore. No. Yeah. Just went in there and bought CDs that I think were $17.98 or something in the 1990s. And talk about inflation. That was, I mean, you know. You can go to any retail store back then and get a CD, a mainstream music CD, for probably $11 or something. But yeah, that was hard on the teenage wallet.
Yeah, you can see why file sharing was so tempting.
Oh yeah, Napster came out when I was in college. Absolutely. Yeah, at a conservative Christian college, and people had Napster on the floor.
Big, like old-timey computer downloading songs.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And then we had, you know, I remember the debates that, because this was a conservative Christian school, was this stealing, you know, to download music for free? Mm-hmm, like we had those debates on the hall. I wanted to ask you about, you know, there's, with the history of Christian music, it contains so many songs about the imminent end of the world. Mm-hmm. This has been just a running theme in this genre for a very long time. The Jesus People of the 1970s, Larry Norman, and the people we've been talking about, he obviously had songs about the rapture. I mentioned I Wish We'd All Been Ready. You know, that true believers in Christ would disappear in the blinking of an eye. We've talked in past episodes a little bit about kind of the baby boomer generation and the trauma that came from the Cold War, that the mm-hmm. nuclear bomb could be dropped and wipe everybody out in the twinkling of an eye, like in an instant. So, but there's been this thematic through line, like through the decades of Christian music, of so many artists dealing with the rapture, the end of the world in some way. And you mentioned this book in your book, Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth, and how this was one of the best-selling books of the 1970s. This really galvanized the Jesus movement, I think, in a lot of ways as people read this book. And I'm curious as to how you see this best-selling book by Hal Lindsey influencing Christian music down through the ages from the 70s out.
Yes, thank you. That's a great question. I think I'd have to go back a little bit earlier with, because I think what Hal Lindsey does, which by the way, I listened to when I was doing research, I listened to an audiobook of Late Great Planet Earth, and whoa. What an experience. It's pretty psychedelic. It was like, you could definitely tell why it took off in the era that it did. You know, it's very, I wanted to hear like the kind of music underneath it, because it felt like that. I was having like an experience, man. Anyway. But yeah, so Hal Lindsey is essentially updating the theology that really got off the ground in the early 20th century. So I think of his book as an application of a really influential Bible called the Scofield Reference Bible, which was created in the early 20th century. And it's essentially the Bible itself was a mechanism that illustrated this theology, premillennial dispensationalism, the idea that, you know, it's for those of you who are, you're probably, I would guess your listeners are really familiar with that term, but includes rapture theology and all that kind of stuff. So Lindsey was, you know, a couple generations in, and I think what makes his stuff so influential in the later 20th century is because he imports this confidence that you can read the world and read this particular theology onto the world, and you can just update it at any point in time. So I don't know, you know, when I teach my students about premillennial dispensationalism, I use these elaborate illustrations that were created in the early 20th century, where they talk about different eras and they have, you know, the rapture, and they eventually have the return of Jesus and the glorious, you know,
victorious eschatology,
the reign of Christ at the end of time. And I look at it and I say, where would you put yourself in time? You know, if you look at this, and I ask my students, where do you think other people put themselves in time? Well, everyone puts themselves right in front of the rapture, right? Like, like nobody thinks they're in like this boring pre-time, you know? So I think really what makes it take off is it is so thrilling. You know, people talk about the horror element of it. And I definitely think that there are elements of horror involved in it. But what I think people don't make enough of is how exciting it is and how enchanted and how thrilling it is to think about yourself at this really important moment in time. And you get to be, you know, you have a front row seat and you get to actually be part of discerning, you know, when these big important events are going to come up. And, you know, if you're an average person just in American suburban life, that can be, you know, kind of repetitive and maybe a little bit boring, but how thrilling is it that, you know, on your way to the grocery store, you could be experiencing the end of time, you know? So I think there's a part of it where it's just, it's entertaining, you know? And I grew up in a very premillennial dispensationalist household. I remember, you know, one time waking up from a nap when I was like maybe 13, 14 years old and being the only person in the house and thinking like, ah, I missed it, you know? And I know I'm not the only one that has had that experience. So they can come with fear, but there's also like an energy to it. And to me, I see that all over the place. You know, the reason why there were Late Great Planet Earth was one of many very books that had healthy sales and CCM songs. There's a ton of them. Some of them are quite well done. You know, Crystal Lewis, People Get Ready. You know, they're like
Crystal Lewis from High Tops, right?
Yes.
The greatest Christian musical of all time.
Why weren't there more of those? Yeah. They should have done more of those.
I do not. We don't have time to go into it. It is my as a kid, that was my favorite album.
Run with your top. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. They should have done more of those.
Run with your high top song.
Oh yeah.
Run. Never stop.
And don't stop.
Never stop.
Yep.
Yeah. Look at you. Look at you. Come on and look at you. Look at you. Run with your high tops. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I know it. I know it.
Who knew that the creators of Salty the Singing Songbook could create something even more iconic to people with taste.
We need to bring it. We need to introduce other people to it because that is way too obscure. It should be brought
to life. I
know
Good Christian Fund did an episode about it. I have lobbied for the entirety of this show for us doing an episode about it, but we've never been like, let's do goofy Christian culture stuff. But it's still like, I love High Tops unequivocally.
And Crystal Lewis is amazing. She was so young in that. Incredible. Yes.
She was. And
I still have never seen it. Zach has been trying to get me. Yeah,
you
I need to watch
to do
it.
Like a live viewing.
Yeah. Oh my
God. Oh, that would be
live tweet it. Oh, I'd watch that for sure.
If we could guarantee that a lot of people would show up, I would like host a screening of it. I do want to point just to go back to Amy Semple McPherson very quickly. I want to point out that with all the dispensationalist rapture, everybody wants to feel like they're part of a thing. You note in the book that she claimed that the imminent return of Jesus for one of the reasons why it was okay to steal radio frequencies.
Oh yeah. You know, the end of the world's coming. You're desperate. You got to get out there. Yeah.
So,
steal those airwaves.
Leah, this is the most exciting part for me. I have to ask you about something extremely important to me.
Uh-oh.
I wouldn't tell Dave what this was. I'll set it up and see what you got here, but I got a lot. I'm going to read a brief quote from your book, and then I just want to hear everything you know about it.
Oh, okay.
Quote, Carmelo Dominic Licciardello, known professionally as Carmen, was something of an oddity on the CCM charts. The charismatic singer, songwriter, actor, entertainer was raised in New Jersey and told dramatic stories of near misses with an infamous crime family. While visiting Disneyland as a young man, Carmen converted at an Andre Crouch concert. Leah, when I read this, I had to know. I don't know. Are you a Disneyland person? I am a Disneyland person. I am currently planning a trip for early December, which, depending on how the election goes, may be extremely necessary for me and my family. But when I read this, I needed to know, where did this happen? Was Carmen saved on Main Street? Was he saved in front of It's a Small World? Was he saved by the rivers of America as the band played on a boat circling the river?
Oh, I love that. I like that version of it the best.
Okay, so you don't know the answer?
My brother, okay. I don't know.
Okay.
I wish I did because that would be even better. But,
interesting,
you know,
that you wish you knew that.
Oh, yeah.
Because I got a bit of a researcher instinct.
Did you go? Did you look it up?
Was it right when
at the top of the Splash Mountain, right before the drop? Is that what
Splash
he got?
Splash Mountain didn't exist until the 90s, man. Or maybe
that's
89.
Right.
Oh. Okay.
Small
I'm
world.
Pasting a link into the chat and I will send it to you in
great.
A second. I needed to know this. Okay. After copious digging, I'm happy to report I know the exact time and place where Carmen converted to Christianity.
Did you find where Andre Crouch was playing?
Yes.
Oh, so good for you.
I learned that there is a series of concerts called the Night of Joy.
It was Night of Joy. I talk about that in the book. Yep.
And I'm not sure if this was the very first one, but I found an article about Carmen from 1996 that said that he'd been saved 20 years previously at a Night of Joy or at an Andre Crouch concert. So I was like, okay, 1976 Night of Joy. So then I wanted to find what date did this occur. Disneyland fans are kind of insane. So I found like a comprehensive like calendar of events for 1976 Disneyland.
You found it was
April 30th, 1976. And then, okay, where did this take place? So I cross-referenced that.
Zach.
Oh, yeah. So I looked up Andre Crouch performances, April 30th, 1976. And I eventually found on the Daniel Amos website. Daniel Amos is another CCM band from the era. That is not the guy's name. That confused me for a long time. I'm like, oh, yeah, duh. Two books of the Bible in order. Okay, I'm sending you a link. If you scroll down to April 30th, you will see the poster for the event. And I'll read the description. So on the calendar archive of this site, it says Daniel Amos
amazing.
Performed
look at, all these names.
At the Night of Joy with Andre Crouch, Love Song, Barry McGuire, Larry Norman, Mustard Seed
what
Faith,
a Jesus
Honey Tree,
lineup.
Children of the Day, two I've never heard of, Parable and Chico Holiday, and Ernie Rettino and Debbie Kerner before they got married and created Salty. One of my favorite CCM jokes is while they were dating and recording, they released an album called Just Friends. And then they got married and released an album called More Than Friends.
I posted those album covers a couple years ago because they were hilarious.
You may
I
have been retweeting me, actually.
Okay, it might have been.
That was me.
Yeah, okay. I love it so much.
The concert went from 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. So we have a five-hour window of Carmen's life transformation. And there it shows the original poster there. And then the description says that this happened at the Golden Horseshoe Saloon in Frontierland, which still exists.
This is a Satan Bite the Dust scenario right here.
That is what my question is going to.
Yes.
I'm like, I think Satan Bite the Dust is him reenacting his conversion.
Yep.
This is incredible.
This is a great theory. Can I tell you?
I would say the Golden Horseshoe Saloon, obviously not a real saloon. It is an old timey place where it was known for this like magician Wally Bogue has the Guinness World Record for the longest running theatrical the longest running stage production in show business history for like 30 years. He did this magic show there, which Steve Martin says is the biggest influence on him becoming
a performer magicians.
At all.
I love seeing magicians.
If you go to the Enchanted Tiki Room, Jose the Parrot, who's sort of your host for that, that's the voice of Wally Bogue. Wally Bogue, who is from Portland. So it all comes up. But yes, Satan Bite the Dust, just imagine it's taking place in the Golden Horseshoe Saloon at Disneyland. That is where Carmen was saved. You can go to Disneyland today. Go into the Golden Horseshoe. It's now
a
restaurant.
Pilgrimage.
They don't have performances there. And you can think to yourself, man, Carmen was really popular and terrible.
Here's
where it all started.
Oh, you know, I get in arguments with people about Carmen all the time because I would say that he was excellent at what he did.
Incredible performer.
He's not maybe everybody's thing. For
a showman. Yeah, incredible showman
reasons.
Is probably better.
But you know, the thing about it's funny because Publishers Weekly reviewed my book, which I just could not even believe was happening. And the one critique they had was that I spent too much time on Carmen.
What?
But you, Zach, have totally justified the time that I spent on Carmen. The thing about it is that he is almost universally panned artistically. People just don't. And, but the thing is that guy sold a lot of records, attracted a lot of people. He was very influential, all the cheesy stuff for all those reasons. When, my friend Dara Delgado and I wrote an article about Carmen when he died, not too long ago. And we wrote about the Disneyland Andre Crouch thing. And it just makes sense because it's like, if Disneyland and Andre Crouch had a child, it would be Carmen. you know, because Carmen used a lot of gospel stuff in his work. And in fact, you know, he doesn't get enough credit. This now here I am. I'm going on and on about Carmen, but he doesn't get enough credit for incorporating a lot more like gospel artists, black gospel artists mm-hmm. and music in his work. So anyway, but all of that to say that Carmen, yes, he was big. This is my favorite moment so far being interviewed because yes. you went further than I did with Carmen. And only another Pentecostal kid would do that, I think. So cheers to you.
Absolutely. And Carmen is also responsible for Stephen Curtis Chapman rapping.
We can have a trial for that. He's guilty. Guilty as charged.
To be true.
Yep. I had a VHS tape. There was a promo for The Great Adventure that my dad got probably at CBA.
Oh.
Had an interview with Stephen saying, "Yeah, I went out to lunch with Carmen," and he's like, "You know what you got to do? You got to rap. Everybody's rapping." And cut to Toby.
I bet you that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, it's basically.
Oh man, there's a lot there. There's like a dissertation right there.
It was so difficult for me to hold in this information. This was a thread waiting to happen.
I bet you got so excited.
I got to tell my wife the whole story last night, and it was so marvelous. Thrilling? It was thrilling. I am levitating having shared this information with you. And it was like Amanda, I'm talking to Leah tomorrow. She's a researcher. She's going to get why this is so cool.
That is excellent. I absolutely love it. I think this is, you know, A+ investigative work. Yes. And what I really appreciated about it is because, you know, he told his story in such over the top ways. He would appreciate it. I think, you know, he'd be like, and then this young man,
did a Carmen style song about me going through this.
He would tell you telling his story. Yeah.
Well, Dr. Leah Bain, thank you so much for joining us for this interview. This is such a fantastic book. Everybody should go get it. 202 pages of the Christian music that you like, that you have nostalgia for, and not just that, the cultural themes, the history. Like, it is just, and it's so fascinating to read.
We didn't get to like,
yeah, there's so many more questions.
Lead up to it and the stuff after, like January 6th and shofars and all that stuff. Like, really run the gamut.
Thank you.
So thorough.
Fantastic.
But so readable. It's not just like densely packed with academic language in order to get all this stuff in there. It's super readable and accessible. So
thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.
Huge recommend from us.
Absolutely. Yep.
Too late for me to blurb it, but you know.
I'll take it. I'll take a post-published blurb. Thank you.
Absolutely.
All right. Everybody go out and get God Gave Rock and Roll to You, A History of Contemporary Christian Music. Dr. Payne, would you like to share any upcoming events and where people can find you on the interwebs?
Oh, yes. You can look up DrLeahPayne, Dr. Leah Payne, on any, not the .com. You can look me up on any social media platform. I even sometimes use TikTok, although it's overwhelming to me. So mostly like Twitter and Instagram and places like that. And then I have a book release party on February 22nd in the Portland area. So if you're there, and you can find that information on my social media channels. And then if you go to my website, you'll find like upcoming events, and I'm doing some digital ones. And so anyway, one of the things I was so surprised, and I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised at how responsive people have been to this book. And so I really would love to talk with people, either online or in person about it. Because it's just like that, that's the whole point of doing something like this for me. So please look me up. I would love to connect.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on here. If you ever want to come back for any reason, I have other questions we didn't get to. I'd love to do a whole show about Amy Semple McPherson.
Here for it. Let's do it.
You're the best. Let's absolutely do it. I wish you the best with the book launch. And it's fantastic stuff. Thank you so much, Leah.
Thank you guys so much. It's just been wonderful.
Dave?
Zach.
I'm sorry that I couldn't let you in on the secret question. Did I blow your mind, though?
Dude, no, seriously. Not for dramatic effect. That is absolutely incredible. Because, of course, I mentioned on the show before, there were, in the mid-90s, Carmen albums I was listening to. And to think he might have got saved. I would call it a strong theory. I mean, you're nailing down times and dates.
When he says he got saved, Frontier, a lot of people land, are like, that's when Disneyland. I got born. Like, he'd been a Christian his whole life, but that's when he became an evangelical, you know?
Wow.
I don't know exactly what he means by that. But, yeah. So you're planning on going to Disneyland at some point in the next couple of years with your kids. You can go to the Golden Horseshoe. Year. And you can luxuriate in the vibes of Carmen.
I will let my kids know this is where Carmen got saved, and they will look at me and say, who?
Oh, good. Okay. When you started that sentence, I was terrified. Like, oh, our absolute favorite musician, Carmen. This is incredible.
My kids love Imagine Dragons these days. That's yeah. The band that they're listening to.
All right, well.
And I didn't really listen to Imagine Dragons before they started.
You've seen commercials, so you've heard Imagine Dragons.
There you go.
All right. Welcome to 2024, everybody. Good to be back. Good to be doing this again. And glad to start it off with a banger. Thank you so much, Talia. That was great.
Truly, truly an incredible book. I'd totally encourage everybody out there to go pick it up for sure. Yeah.
Wanna take us out?
Let's go out. This has been another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. Thank you so much for listening to us. We have a Patreon, Patreon.com/VCW Pod. You can also, wherever you like to get podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review, as that helps other people find the show. You can find us on X, Twitter, whatever. I am at Dave J. Lester. Zach is at Muzach, M-U-Z-A-C-H. Go to Zach's website, bandcamp.muzak.com. I think I got that right. It's been a while.
Muzak.bandcamp.com. Yeah, that's
there right. We go. That one. You can go there and check out some of Zach's music and pick up a record of his or two. I also have another podcast, Does the Bible Say That? Wherever fine podcasts are sold.
Thanks again for coming on down to the VCW. And remember, as always, the podcast is free, but you still need to tithe 10%.